he's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
And good morning and welcome. How do the Ten Commandments speak to us in today's culture? We're going to be unpacking that very important issue here in the next hour or so as we talk to Sean Gladding. He's the author of The Story of God, The Story of Us, and his new book called 10 Words of Life for an Addicted, Compulsive, Cynical, Divided, and Worn Out Culture. Whew, boy, that speaks to our culture, doesn't it? And I think you will find his perspective very refreshing, and I think it's something that will help all of us to grow in our Christian faith. So stick around for that in just a few minutes. And as you heard, our phone number, 877-93-FAITH. If you have any questions for Sean during the program or for me, would love to hear from you. The new movie Noah is coming out in just a couple weeks. Of course, The Son of God opened last weekend to pretty positive reviews and big ticket sales, which is great. Always great to send Hollywood that type of a message. So what about Noah? Noah is the big blockbuster, supposedly going to be a blockbuster, starring Russell Crowe. And is it going to be faithful to the biblical account in Genesis? Well, maybe yes, maybe no in some ways. Jerry Johnson, who's the president of the National Religious Broadcasters, has asked Paramount Pictures to add a disclaimer to the advertising for Noah. The studio is advising filmgoers that the movie is, quote, inspired by the story of Noah and that artistic license has been taken. Paramount says it believes the film is, as they say, true to the essence, values, and integrity of the story from the book of Genesis. But Jerry Johnson from the NRB previewed the film. Here's what he says. He praises its acting. He says the production is incredible. He appreciates the faithfulness to the biblical story's main elements of sin and judgment and restoration. But he does have one word of warning. He says that in the movie, the flood appears to be a punishment for man's destruction of the environment. No. Oh, my gracious. The eco-terrorists have gone crazy here. Yeah, I haven't seen it. It opens on March 28th. I'm glad to hear that it deals with sin and judgment and restoration. I'm glad to hear that it sounds like a fantastic production. Russell Crowe does a great job as Noah. But I don't find that in Genesis. We're to be good stewards of the earth, certainly, and we haven't always done such a great job with that, but we'll have to see. I guess we'll have to see it for ourselves and see if we agree with that perspective. So be watching for Noah March 28th in theaters. Story about Pope Francis out in the news this week. The Pope says he's just a normal guy. He's not super Pope. Pope Francis says he's kind of troubled by some of the media hype about him. He was being interviewed by an Italian newspaper, and the Pope said he doesn't appreciate this myth-making, as he calls it. He says the Pope is a man who laughs, cries, sleeps, and has friends like everyone else, a normal person. I love that perspective. He is a normal guy. Did you know the Pope once worked as a bouncer in a bar? Yeah, I guess in Buenos Aires. Probably, I don't know if it was before he was a priest. I'm not sure. This whole background, he's had a couple different jobs. I think he swept floors in a store. So he's been a normal guy. So great perspective from Pope Francis. But he's not completely just a regular guy because he does get to drive around in that cool Pope mobile. Well, interesting. Hey, I found a story about internet use and social media. I thought you'd find this interesting. We are logged on in record numbers now. Americans, according to a new Pew Research study, 87% of Americans are now online. That is the highest number ever recorded. And among the people that use the internet on a regular basis, 90% of them say it's been good for them personally. 76% say the internet is a good thing for society as a whole, and 57% say it would be very hard to give it up. I'm sure it would be, because we count on it in so many ways. Interestingly, though, the people surveyed said that getting rid of Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram would not be that difficult. In fact, only 11% of Americans surveyed thought that losing social media would cause any kind of hardship. I'm surprised at that low number, because there just are a lot of people who are addicted to social media. It's a big concern of mine. You may have heard me talk about this in the past, because I think it keeps us from real authentic relationships. But only 11% in the survey said they thought it would be a big deal to lose access to social media. And speaking of social media, new study out suggesting that it may be undermining our ability to think for ourselves, to think critically. Researchers at the University of Edinburgh conducted a study that involved asking people a series of trick questions. One group answered the questions alone, while the second group was allowed to see the answers of other people in a simulated social network. The people in that second group often changed their answers after seeing the other people's responses, while those who answered the questions in isolation didn't change their mind. The lead researcher of the study says he believes that the rise of information-sharing websites like Twitter and Facebook will make us rely more and more on the opinions of others. And he says this could interfere with our ability to think critically and make us lazy. Why is that? Well, because we assume there's always going to be somebody else who knows the answer and who can tell us. But can we trust them? Maybe not. You get into some of this groupthink phenomenon, and I think it could be very dangerous. So, interesting new research studies on that. It's 11 minutes past the hour. You are listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer, and coming up next, my guest, Sean Gladding, the author of 10, A Refreshing New Look at the Ten Commandments. I think you'll find it fascinating. Stick with us.
A growing number of kids today are suffering from an emotional characteristic known as a wounded spirit.
For Family Talk, here's Dr. James Dobson.
The wounded spirit is the title of a book written by best-selling author Frank Peretti about his own painful childhood experiences. Mr. Peretti was born with a tumor in his jaw that disfigured him and led to unmerciful taunting during his childhood years. Other children called him a monster, and they treated him with disdain and rejection. It took Frank many years to come to terms with his grotesque identity, long after the tumor had been successfully removed. Millions of adults and children today can relate to Mr. Peretti. I talked with a mother recently who said her teenage boy had actually lost his desire to live because of the ridicule of his peers over his slightly protruding ears. Suicide even loomed as a possibility. It's true that this kind of teasing and ridiculing has been going on forever among children, but today's kids are even more vulnerable to it, primarily because of the emphasis on beauty in the popular culture and the way Hollywood depicts the have-nots as nerds and freaks and geeks. Those with wounded spirits often gravitate toward drug addiction, violence, early sexual activity, and even emotional illness. It is our obligation as adults to protect these vulnerable kids as much as possible.
There's more Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson at MyFamilyTalk.com.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And welcome back. So great to have you with us today. Our phone number is 877-93-FAITH if you'd like to connect with us. Of course, you can always find us on the web at myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. And you can send us an email if you want through our Connect page. Actually, just go to my show page, and there's a little connection link. And you can send us an email during the program. And also, if you want to call in the next 40 minutes or so and give us your contact info, what I will do is put your name into a drawing for a copy of the book 10 by our guest, Sean Gladding. We have a couple of copies to give away, but you got to call us, I would say, before 11:55. at 877-93-FAITH. Give us your name, address, phone number, email, and we'll put you into the drawing, and you will love this new book. Well, my guest is Sean Gladding. He is originally from Norwich, England. He has made his home in the U.S., though, for the last 20 years. He attended Asbury Theological Seminary, and he has served in various forms of pastoral ministry. Sean's first book, The Story of God, The Story of Us, had its origins in a Bible study that he led during a summer internship at Mercy Street. Mercy Street is a church in Houston, Texas, for people recovering from addiction and from bad church experiences, sometimes from both. Sean went on to co-pastor Mercy Street for 7 years, and in that time, he and his wife, Rebecca, narrated the story of God with people who had never heard it before, or maybe had heard a distorted or a fragmented version of that story. Sean and Rebecca now live in Lexington, Kentucky. They live with friends at Communality, which is a part of the family of new monastic communities in the U.S. And Sean, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thanks, Bill. It's lovely to be with you this morning.
It is a true pleasure. And before we dive into your book, tell us a bit about the new monastic movement. What exactly is it, and how did it begin?
There's all kinds of answers to that question. And so I'll start with my own experience of it, which was while I was at Asbury Seminary working on a divinity degree, some friends got together with a couple of folk who had been part of the Jesus People movement in the 70s, who said, what would it be like to live in an intentional Christian community now, 30 years on? And so a bunch of us moved into Lexington, and we had two men's houses and a women's house. And we began to ask, what does it mean for us to love God and to love our neighbors as ourselves, especially our neighbors who are on the margins of life? And so we spent 4 years in community. We gathered frequently to share meals. We got to know our neighbors who lived outside, or our neighbors who are living in the pay-by-the-week flop houses around where we gathered, and began to ask the question, what does it mean to live together in intentional community and to find ways to share what God has given us with others, and to see what God has given others that they have to share with us that they may not value themselves yet? And so we weren't alone in doing that. There have been people doing that for a long time. There's Reba Place in Chicago. It's been there for 40-something years. Koinonia Farms down south has been doing it for 30-something years. And then there are other communities scattered around the country. And just through conversation with each other, we said, hey, you're kind of doing what we're doing. What can we learn from you? And so that, I don't know if it's a movement, but it's a community of communities of people who are seeking the way of Jesus very intentionally, either living together or living in proximity to each other. So today, 16 years on from when Communality started, we no longer live under the same roof, but most of us live in the same neighborhood and continue to share our life together with each other and with our neighbors. And all kinds of beautiful Kingdom of God things are happening.
It's wonderful. One practical question for you. I'm thinking of Acts 2, and Paul made his living as a tent maker. Obviously, you have to have some kind of financial support. Do you raise support, missionary support, or do each of you have different jobs to bring in income, or how do you do it?
Yeah, it varies, but most people have regular jobs, although some of us have started non-profits, and that's the employment opportunity. So one of the members of Communality, Ryan Cook, started a non-profit called Seedleaf. And we live in the north side of Lexington, which is what people call a food desert. There are no grocery stores here that sell fresh produce. And so people have to leave the neighborhood to get access to that, which is at least two bus trips. And so he said, how can we help people not only have access to fresh food, but also learn how to grow food themselves, knowing that diet is sort of the foundational building block for good health? And so he started a nonprofit called Seedleaf doing that. He runs an entrepreneurial program for middle school students, teaching them some basic skills on not only how to grow food, but also then how to market it and sell it. So learning some life skills that way. Other members are social workers or working in local government. There are some who are raising, living as missionaries, urban missionaries, and raising support, but also bivocational, you know, having jobs as well. So it varies from person to person. We have some folk who are in the medical profession. That's how we support ourselves.
Interesting. And do many of these folks have children? And if so, how do the children take to this sort of lifestyle?
Yeah, you know, in fact, most of us do. If you were to gather with us on a Sunday evening for dinner, you would notice that probably half of our community are under the age of 10.
Hmm.
So most of us started as unmarried seminary students or college students, but then a lot of us married each other. When you spend that much time together, that tends to happen, and began to have children. So I think for most of our children, this is the only life they've known. So it wouldn't feel strange because this is the life that they know. And our children have all kinds of friends, some that they may never have made if we had chosen not to live where we live and live the way we live.
Mm. One question I often ask people who live in this type of arrangement or even missionaries who may live in very dangerous situations is we obviously want to trust our children to God's care and provision. But as a parent, we're also protective and we don't want to put our kids in dangerous situations. And I don't know what the area that you live in is like, but I've talked to some folks who've lived in inner city situations or overseas in mission situations where there is real danger on a daily basis. How do you cope with that, or the folks that you know in other monastic communities, how do they cope with that when it comes to their kids?
Again, I don't really want to speak for people other than myself and our own experience, but I would say that the neighborhood where we live in, it has its challenges, and there are certainly occasional flare-ups of gun violence. And for the first time last summer, shots were fired on our street, which was a new thing. But I can honestly tell you that we have never felt afraid, simply because we actually know our neighbors. We know the people around whom we live and have good relationships with them. And often the violence that does happen is people coming into the neighborhood who don't actually live here, often because they're coming here for the drug trade that happens here, or this past summer there was a lot of gambling that was happening in the park at the end of our street. And like I said, though, we don't feel unsafe here. We just are very wise and cautious when we need to be. And like I said, mostly it's because we know our neighbors that we feel secure, that we have each other's backs and are watching out for each other. And those situations, when the rare times that they do happen, you know, we had a conversation, my wife and I, about that. And our conviction is, you know, if Jesus said the greatest commandment, the way, if you like to sum up the 10 words, the 10 commandments, is to love God and to love your neighbor as yourself. And even though we may not be affluent, we have resources. And so we could choose to leave this neighborhood if we wanted and move somewhere that may not have some of the challenges that this neighborhood has. But most of our neighbors don't. That's not an option for them.
Right.
And so what does it mean if we want to live securely and safely, we could do that by moving, but our neighbors can't, what does it mean to love them as we love ourselves? And we came to the conclusion, again, that it means to stay put here and to try and make the neighborhood a better place to live with them, so that their kids, who, you know, don't have to live, you know, in fear or whatever. So that's our sort of conviction, and at this point we've been able to live by it, that's the life we've chosen, and it's deeply rewarding. You know, we love our life here.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard that same sentiment echoed by others who were in similar situations, and it does take certainly a great deal of trust in God when there are real present dangers at times, and you have children. Now, your book 10. Has its origins in a sermon series you did on the 10 words you preached when you were a pastor at Mercy Street in Houston. But in this particular book, you chose to write it as a story instead of nonfiction. What made you decide to do that?
That's a really good question. Bill. About a year after my first book came out, my publisher, InterVarsity Press, especially the editor that I work with, said, why don't you write another book? And I think the sermon series you did on the Ten Commandments would make a great book. And so we signed a contract and went into doing that. And I started, with the raw material I had, which was these sermons. And so I started writing. And after, 3 or 4 months, I'd written maybe 3 chapters, and I was really not happy with them at all. And so I just sent them to my editor, said, I'm really struggling. I can't seem to write in a way that's pleasing to me. And I said, can you give me some feedback on what I've done? And he read them and said, they really are preachy. And for me, it was like, well, that sounds very much because they're based on sermons. And so I went to my wife, who's a great source of wisdom and insight, and I said, I'm really struggling. She said, well, why don't you stop trying to write a book, and why don't you do what you do best, which is tell a story? And so then I had this idea to say, a lot of this, the material in the sermons, came from conversations I had with the small group that helped me prepare each week for preaching. Maybe I could, sort of recount some of that and incorporate the material in an imagined conversation, some of which content reflects a real conversation, others which was, imagined. And so that's how it became then the format it is. And suddenly it just came alive. And it's like, yes, this is the way to teach what I want to teach about the 10 words, but in this very relational, very conversational way that is this, the genre of discoursive fiction. So,
So you in the story, are you writing it as the pastor, or is the pastor one of several characters?
The voice is kind of sort of it's removed. It's someone observing the conversation, but myself, where I fit into the book, really is in that pastoral figure, John, but the voice of the book is actually sort of an all knowledgeable outsider who's looking in on all of this, who knows what people are thinking, who knows what is going on in people's hearts, and sort of reflecting that way. But I hope that, the characters in the conversation each week as it unfolds in the coffee shop, I hope the people who read the book will find at least one or two that they relate to and identify with. I've tried to make them sort of composite characters of friends or people I've known. And they're not all Christians. There are people who are very sort of antagonistic towards that experience of the church. And again, that reflects my time with Mercy Street, where so many people that was the case had been very wounded by church members or family members who were Christians. But really trying to model a very generous conversation where people are willing to actually listen to other people's opinions. Because I think that's something that's sorely lacking at this point in American culture, that seems like we really are getting further and further polarized and setting into harder and harder positions, refusing to think there's anything good in another person's argument if they disagree with us, or even anything good in that person because they disagree with us. And I think that is anathema to the gospel. I think that is anathema to the ministry that Paul says we've all been given, which is the ministry of reconciliation. And so I've tried to model respectful discourse with not saying you have to agree with me for us to be friends, but say as you become friends with people who are not like you, do you become more sympathetic for not just what they think, but who they are? And so, as I said, I hope this gets a wide readership. My first book did. It wasn't read by all church-going folk or Christians. And I hope it's the same for this, as I hope whoever picks this book up, they'll find a character to identify with in the story.
And I would venture to say that will happen. It's a fascinating book. Again, it's called 10 Words of Life for an Addicted, Compulsive, Cynical, Divided, and Worn Out Culture. I get tired just reading that list, Sean. It's my gracious. But unfortunately, that's the sort of world we live in. And we're going to unpack this book and some of these characters here in just a bit here on the Faith Radio Network. If you'd like to call with any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. 877-93-FAITH is the number, and you can find us online at myfaithradio.com. I'm Bill Meyer. Stick with us. We'll be right back with more with Sean Gladding after this quick break.
Yeah. Thank you for your friendship, prayers, and support of Faith Radio. God is using this ministry in remarkable ways. Recently, we received a message from a young man who spent much of last year in a fruitless search for work after college. The stress took its toll on his spiritual life, and he wrote, "I had distanced myself away from Jesus. I thought that he wasn't blessing me or answering prayer. But then he started listening to Faith Radio, and it made a big impact on his life. He said, through your radio station, I have come to realize that God has a much greater plan for me." Thank you, friends, for making stories like this possible through your generous prayers and support of Faith Radio. Our upcoming spring share is April 8, 9, and 10. If you're already supporting this ministry, thank you. If not, please consider a special gift during spring share. Thank you, and God bless you. Find out how you can give simply and safely online at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.
Continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And we do want to hear from you, whether you're listening to us here in the Twin Cities, or perhaps in Madison, or Fargo, or Sioux Falls. Maybe you've got us on in Waterloo or Duluth. Did I leave anybody out? I don't think so. We would love to hear from you, 877-93-FAITH. And give us your contact info. We'll enter you into a drawing for our a copy of one of these wonderful books, 10 Words of Life for an Addicted, Compulsive, Cynical, Divided, and Worn-Out Culture by our guest, Sean Gladding. Sean, in the story, which we mentioned before, this was a sermon series that you did when you were in Houston, but then you turned it into a story, which I love because I think story can teach us so much. It can reach the heart, both the heart and the mind. The pastor refers to the Ten Commandments as the 10 words. Why does he do that, and what difference does it make to the characters?
Most of us are very familiar with the Ten Commandments. You know, even in America, still, it's not a post-Christian culture like the United Kingdom is. And so even if people don't know what they are, they've still heard of the Ten Commandments. But interestingly enough, if you actually read the Hebrew Bible, only one time in the whole of Scripture are they referred to as the Ten Commandments. Everywhere else, they're referred to as the Ten Words, which is where we get the word Decalogue from, another word for the Ten Commandments. And so even at the beginning of Exodus 20, it says, "And God spoke all these words to Moses." And so the reason they're not really commandments in the technical sense is that there is no punishment ascribed for breaking them. If you read the rest of the law, all the other commandments, if you break this commandment, this is what happens to you. But in the 10 words, there's none of that. And so I really wanted to emphasize that reality, and again, realizing that most of us still approach the Ten Commandments as rules and not as words, or as I tend to talk about them, as practices that God gives us to adopt, rather than rules either to keep or not. And so I think thinking about them as rules has not really been helpful for us, especially in this stage of cultural movement in the United States. And so because it's our rules and they become something, I think when we talk about them as rules, what we usually mean is those are rules that those people over there ought to keep. And I think that's why we argue and fight to try and get them posted in public places like courthouses to say, America, we sense it's going in the wrong direction morally. What we need is if we just posted the Ten Commandments in courthouses, then that would be a reminder of the rules by which our society should be governed. And, you know, while I think there is something to that, I think much more helpful and probably more faithful to the scriptures is these are things that God has given to us, those who claim to follow Jesus, as practices to embody ourselves rather than rules to impose on other people. The idea being that if we actually lived according to what the Ten Commandments, the Ten Words, call us to, I think that would be far more compelling than people seeing them carved into stone on a courthouse lawn. And that's always the challenge with Scripture. It's much easier to argue about what the Bible does or doesn't say, or what this means or what it doesn't mean, rather than actually try to embody that in the way we live our life. And I think that our life is what is the most compelling witness to the gospel, and not our ability to talk about what the Bible says or what we think it says. And so I hope in terms of talking about them as the 10 words or 10 practices, especially in the context for which they are given, that's a helpful way into this really countercultural way of life that the Bible calls us to, and that Jesus embodied and then called us as his disciples to live.
Tell me about some of the characters in the book. Who are they, and what are their backgrounds, and how do they interact with this pastor?
Yeah, so the context is that this pastor, his day off is Mondays, and he's sitting in his favorite coffee shop early in the morning, and one of the characters in the coffee shop that everyone knows and loves starts berating the Christians because of what he sees in the headline of the newspaper that day, which ironically was the actual headline in my local newspaper, the Lexington Herald Leader, on the day I sat down to begin writing the book. And right on the front cover of the paper were these words, 10 Commandments Fight Proves Costly. And two counties in eastern Kentucky, the poorest part of our state, had fought for the right to post the 10 Commandments in their courthouses all the way to the Supreme Court and lost. And the report said, you know, if you've been following this story, this is the end. And what it's meant is that these counties now owe the ACLU $500,000 in legal fees. And they admit that, frankly, they don't know where the money's going to come from. Mm. And so this character says, what do you think about that, Pastor? What do you think about, you know, you Christians doing stuff like that? So it's very provocative, you know, and questions that I've heard people have asked me. And then the pastor begins to respond, and as often happens, if you're in the kind of coffee shops, at least that I hang out in, other people get involved, drawn into the conversation, share their own opinions. And so the conversation, you know, begins around that, and then that becomes sort of the focal point for a wider discussion about American culture in general and the sort of way we have a sense that we're losing our way. Whatever we think, we recognize that this is not the kind of world, the kind of country we thought we were living in, that there are all kinds of challenges, social challenges we're facing, and politicians don't seem to be helping us address them. And so that then leads into this pastor saying, you know what, this has been really stimulating, and I've been wondering about preaching a sermon series. Maybe I should preach a series on the Ten Commandments, and maybe you guys could help me prepare that each week. Would you be willing to come back every Monday and have a conversation? And so that's sort of how the setting for the book takes place. And so week by week, and that small group and then some other people are added to it, get together for an hour to discuss one of the Ten Commandments each week, which really modeled how I am approached the sermon series, which is I got together about 6 months before I planned to preach with a group on Wednesday nights, which was very diverse, and we looked at one of the commandments. We read some other scriptures around it and then had a discussion. Where does this word intersect with your life? What do you think about this? What are the implications for this? And so some of the other characters that join the conversation are folk from the pastor's church, so they self-identify as Christians. And several of them are in recovery from addiction. And then there's a couple of high school students who join the conversation in, I think, the third week to bring a more youthful perspective, perhaps. So it's a pretty diverse group, and that's the sort of the group that then has this conversation each week about one of the words.
Who's the character that first confronts the pastor? You said kind of a local character.
Yeah, his name is Steve, and I have known lots of Steves. When you've been a pastor, if any of people listening are in pastoral or self, you know, where people know you as a church employee or a pastor, then if you're in a public setting, you become the expert on the faith, on Christianity, or even any religion sometimes, and people say, hey, what do you think about that pastor? You're a pastor, you should know. And so I've known several characters like that, and they're lovely, and I thoroughly enjoy people. And have friends with folk who still would not consider themselves at all religious, but love talking about matter, you know, things that really matter in life.
I'm curious. So Yeah, I'm curious, how did the pastor respond to this gentleman when he initially confronts him on the Ten Commandments in the courthouse issue? What was his response to this very confrontive gentleman?
Well, it, again, modeled on the way what I have learned over the years is to ask a question rather than get defensive, which was, and so he says, so why do you think people would be willing to spend $500,000 of taxpayers' money to fight for the right to post those, you know, on court? Can you imagine any reason why people might do that? And so other people begin to give answers to that question and then says, I wonder if the reason people do that is because not a headline on the front page, but all the headlines inside the newspaper. And so he invites Steve to open the paper and start reading the headlines out. And what do you find in the headlines in a local newspaper pretty much every day? You find talk of theft. You find talk of murder. You find talk of sex scandals of some kind, of politicians lying about other politics. Like, so all the content of the 10 words you can find in the other headlines. And so the pastor says, I wonder if that's why, you know, it's when people read the newspaper or watch the news or just pay attention to what's happening around them, they say, this isn't how we should treat each other. And maybe people just want something concrete to point to and say, that is how we ought to treat each other. For better, for worse, at least there's a succinct summary, right, of addressing the things that you and I know are challenges in our neighborhood and in our culture. And so that's how he begins to respond.
I love it. I love it. You're reminding me a lot of Tim Keller from Manhattan and his use of questions when he's talking to people who may be hostile to the gospel, maybe skeptics, agnostics. Tim typically uses that same line, and I love it. His book, Reason for God or Reasons for God, does that same sort of a thing. In the book, 10, you chose to go through the Ten Commandments in the reverse order. And what was your rationale for that?
Again, I'm borrowing from other folk. My parents still live in England. And many, many years ago, they told me that they'd been a traveling evangelist who'd come to our hometown, Norwich, and was doing a series on the Ten Commandments in a very public venue. And not a church, but it's in a public venue. And she's, you know, my parents are saying, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people are coming out every week, and it's not all church folk. And so I was intrigued. I said, well, tell me, why would in England, why would lots of people show up to hear? And she says, that's not just the way he's talking about them. He's very practical. And so I began to research this guy. His name is Jay John. And I read an interview with him, and he said, you know, in a post-Christian culture like the UK, if you want to talk about the Ten Commandments, if you start with the first one, that there is a God, you know, most people aren't going to come back the following week. But if you start with the Tenth Commandment, which is don't want what other people have, well, you know, our economy is based on that. Everyone relates to that. Everyone understands that. So they might come back the next week, and then it's about lying and, you know, not telling the truth and spin. Well, everybody experiences that. And so, you know, people, you hit these last few words, which if you preach them in the reverse order, hit people where they live. And he said, so for some people, if they keep coming back and not only hit them in terms of what other people do, but begin to identify all the ways that they have broken and don't keep these words, if they stick around and get to the first word, which is there is a God who has set you free from slavery, for some people that suddenly becomes good news. It just made total sense to me. And so when it came to preaching the series ourselves at Mercy Street, we did it in that order. And again, in writing the book, I wanted to do it in that order. So that, again, that who doesn't relate to the first few? And then as it gets to the more sort of obtuse, don't have idols, you know, don't bless, you know, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Well, if you've been working through all these other things, these begin to, you might have a better sense of what these other words might mean.
Great perspective. I love it, Sean. We're talking to Sean Gladding. He is the author of the brand new book, 10 Words of Life for an Addicted, Compulsive, Cynical, Divided, and Worn Out Culture. And we have three copies of the book to give away if you'd like to call us at 877-93-FAITH. Give us your contact info. We'll have a drawing at the end of the hour. And if you have any questions for Sean, by all means, give us a call right now, and we'll pass those along to him. It's 11:45, and you are listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more with Sean in just a bit.
In 2014, we're planting truth together on Faith Radio. Here's this week's Bible passage and word from Pastor Andy Stanley.
Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. Did you know your heritage is a pattern of the world? Just because your daddy did it, your great-granddaddy did it, that's just a pattern of the world. Paul says, you don't have to be the same as all of them. Look at the verse. But be transformed. How? By the renewing of your mind. So that you might be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. See, when you start playing those tapes and that old thing comes around, well, I can't help it, I can't change, you stop and you say, no. I am not going to be conformed any longer to the pattern of this world. I'm going to be transformed by the renewing of my mind so that I can test and approve what God's will is, His good, perfect, and perfect will for my life.
Planting truth and growing together, this week on Faith Radio. See all the verses and commit them to memory at myfaithradio.com.
It's like my eyes were opened. I kind of knew what I wanted to study, but after discovering what Northwestern had to offer in that field, I finally saw the path.
At Northwestern's Major Discovery, Thursday, March 20th at 5 p.m., your student can learn more about specific majors and take a step closer to deciding what to study in college and where to study it. You can enjoy a nice dinner and visit with professors and students. To register, visit unwsp.edu/visit. University of Northwestern, St. Paul, your life on purpose.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. Our guest, Sean Gladding, the author of the new book, 10. Michael Frost, the author of Exile, says, you've never heard the Ten Commandments taught quite like this. And it's true, as Sean has described, it's a pastor in a coffee shop talking to a group of people, and they're actually helping him prepare his sermon series on the Ten Commandments. And let's dive into a few of the commandments. One of the things that you say in the book, or the, I guess the pastor would say it, or maybe it's one of the characters, envy equals desire plus resentment. And I'm wondering, how does that play out in the book? And what is what on a more practical basis, what is the antidote for that in today's materialistic, narcissistic culture?
Again, great question. That is actually a formula that my best friend and co-pastor at Mercy Street came up with during the series. It's this idea that envy is equal to desire plus resentment. It's not just that I want something, it's that I resent the fact that someone else has it. And that's a key component of envy. It's the old story of trying to keep up with the Joneses, right? It's not enough for me to have what I have. If my neighbor has something better, then I need to have it so I can keep up with them. So there's this resentment. So instead of finding delight that other people have certain things, we learn to resent them for having them and try and either get them ourselves or perhaps even tear down what they have. And so I think that in some ways, the cynical part of our culture, that our advertising is based on creating desire for things we didn't even know we knew, that we didn't know we needed until we're bombarded with messages that say things like, you deserve this, you need this, it's your right to have this, or that some of the language, especially you deserve, that's a very much the language of advertising in my experience. And so I think the antidote, one of the antidotes for envy or the sense of, I deserve this, whatever this is gratitude, is learning to be thankful for what we already have. A good friend of mine who's an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous often says, Sean, if you woke up tomorrow morning and the only possessions you had and the only relationships you had left were those that you had been grateful for today, what kind of home would you wake up to? Yeah. And I think so often we're bombarded with messages that tell us what we lack, what we don't have, that we fail to be grateful for what we have. And so that what I think the word against envy invites us into is a life of contentment, to be satisfied with what we already have. And once we begin to learn that, I think it begins to change fundamentally how we approach possessions and how we approach our neighbors. So instead of being jealous for my friend who just got a brand new Harley Davidson and I'm still riding the same one I've been riding for 22 years, I can celebrate for him and not feel like, well, I need to get one. Why don't I have that? Why hasn't my life worked out? I'm like, you know what? I have a Harley Davidson. And yes, it's 30-something years old, but it still runs. It's a great bike. And I need that reminder. And so I think contentment and gratitude is the antidote to envy and desire plus resentment.
Mm. You know, we're trying in our home to work on that very issue with our children. I have three kids who are 11, 9, and 7, and wonderful children, but there is a lot of envy going on. He got this, she got this, and right now it's over kind of silly things, one of which is playdates. Well, he got more playdates with his friends than I got, and we're trying to help them to learn to be content. And to learn, as you said, to celebrate when their sibling, you know, gets something positive, wonderful, time with a friend is something that, you know, you should celebrate for him instead of saying, I didn't get as many. And it is a real challenge. And I was talking to my wife the other day, and I said, this is just driving me crazy, this envy between these three kids who have so much, so many blessings. And I try to remind them, you know, we sponsor two kids through Compassion, and I try to remind them, well, you know, Jose in down there in Peru, he ain't going to be going out for frozen yogurt. I mean, he and yet,
right.
I so I'm kind of going up against this brick wall with them, and my wife brought me back to earth and said, hun, it's the sin nature. And I went, well, yeah, I guess that's true. Hopefully we'll outgrow it.
It's also developmental, right, at that age.
Yes.
But it's just part of it. And so all we can do is keep enforcing, you know, and I have a 10 and an 8-year-old, so this is not something I'm unfamiliar with. But we just keep reminding them, well, what was good? What was good? What do you have? And hopefully in that just constant repetition, some of that will slowly sink in. But clearly, most of us continue to still struggle with that. So it's a lifelong challenge. But again, it's one that because we forget, we need to be reminded. And so that's why I think God tells Moses, and Moses says, you know, write these on your heart, write them on your forehead, you know, get them into your kids. When you're walking on the road, talk about them, like, because we're so quick to forget these very basic things about what it means to live in community with others where we want the best for each other. So we create the kind of society where everyone can flourish, not just a few.
Mm. Another issue you tackle in the book, one of the commandments, which, of course, this is so significant given our sex-saturated culture, is thou shalt not commit adultery. And we have so many in our society who see a commandment, a rule like that, as being unrealistic and incredibly restrictive and narrow-minded. Can you explain, and how your character explains in the book, how it actually brings freedom to our lives?
Yeah, again, this is one perspective, but I think there's a great deal of truth in this, in that it's not, you know, the problem is not that our culture thinks about sex and talks about sex so much. I think the problem is that our culture talks about sex so poorly. And it just reflects our ongoing, highly individualistic culture, which sex is about my self-satisfaction, my need to be fulfilled, and it's very much an emphasis on my rights to have the kind of sex life I think I ought to have. And I think that, again, runs completely counter to the revelation of God and humanity in the scriptures, which is, no, it's not about you and your personal satisfaction. It really is about being part of a people who are seeking the welfare of everybody. And so how do you learn in every area of your life to be self-giving, not self-satisfying? And so I think it's no different in the area of sex than any other area, including the one you've just talked about, material possessions. How do I, you know, learn to not try to satisfy all of my desires, but how do I want, you know, for people to have what they need to have? And so when it comes to sexuality, I think, yes, you can say, do not commit adultery. Well, what if, you know, what if my spouse can't meet my needs? You know, well, that's one thing to recognize is that's legitimate. You know, all of us have legitimate needs, and one of those is sexuality, you know, a legitimate need to have a sexual expression that is healthy and life-giving and meaningful. And what do you do if your spouse doesn't meet the need that you have? I'm not sure the best answer is to go find someone else, because often it's not only the issue isn't often the other person in the equation. There's often something inside ourselves that's part of that. Also, I think our culture has entirely unrealistic expectations about what sexual satisfaction is. And so, again, returning to the very core, the very beginning of our story, this beautiful description of the first human couple who were naked and unashamed, that I think very, very few of us in this culture ever feel unashamed when we're naked. Whether that's naked physically or naked emotionally or naked spiritually, we feel a lot of shame around that. And so how do you learn to become unashamed about your sexuality? How do you learn to become unashamed about your physicality? It's by having a safe place to get naked with someone else. And I truly believe the safest place in the world for the sexual relationship and the safest place in the world to make yourself vulnerable with another human being is in a covenanted relationship, where you have made commitments and promises to each other, for better or for worse, in every area of our life. I'm not going anywhere. And so if our sex life is not what we might want, we're not going to go anywhere. We're going to say, how can we figure this out? How do we get help with this? And that is the work of years. And sometimes the church has told the equal and opposite untruth, which is, if you just save yourself from marriage, then your sex life will be great. I think that's not true. As anyone who has done that has probably realized, you know, marriage is hard work. You know, beautiful shared sexuality is hard work. None of this is easy. But the key is to have a safe container within which to work that out. And I really believe covenanted relationships are the safest place for that to happen. And so what we find is that if you go looking for that somewhere else, you may find it briefly, as many people do. But then if you break up one marriage and move into the other one, then all the things that you brought to your own first marriage that you know, were part of the problem, you bring right into the second one. And so the challenge, and we do the same with the church, right? We, you know, well, my needs aren't being met in this church, so I'm going to go find another church.
Exactly.
We do the same thing rather than say, what do I have to bring to this? Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. We're just about out of time for the hour.
And okay.
I'm sorry we've only had a chance to unpack a few of the commandments, but I want to encourage our listeners to get this book, Sean Gladding's 10, and you will find the 10 commandments will come alive in a brand new way. Thank you for your time today, Sean, your commitment to biblical truth, and we appreciate you so much.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on your show, Bill.